The last time we were dealing with the Baptist distinctives, what was the discussion about? Can anyone remember? Yes. Okay, good. Pastor, elder, bishop. Are these all different offices? Or are they same? The same office?
The same office.
Okay.
Different responsibilities are different.
Okay. Different aspects of their work. We could say different aspects of their work. Of those three terms, which one is the most commonly used in the New Testament? Elder, okay. Which one best describes the day-to-day work of the office? Well, I guess technically bishop, I mean, is an overseer, so that is, I guess, in part. I would say that pastor, though, probably better describes the day-to-day work of the office. And then bishop means overseer. It means that is where the authority, the spiritual authority, lies in the church under the authority of Christ. So we have two offices, and we talked a little bit about why we believe there are two offices, not five or six offices. So then after that, we wanted to get a little bit into the work of a pastor, or we could say the nature of that office. So with that in mind, let's look down at 1 Peter chapter 5. And I'd like to ask if someone could read 1 Peter 5, verses 1 to 4 for us, nice and loud so that we can hear that well, please.
The elders who are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Heed the flock of God who is among you. Take me oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but for ready mind. Neither as being wards over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. When the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away.
Okay, very good, thank you. So this passage is an excellent passage describing the nature of a pastor's work. Notice a couple of things that are stated here. He says, the elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ. Now, when Peter is writing this epistle, he's writing to the average believer. So when he uses that term, the elders which are among you, it's giving us an indication that though a pastor has authority, spiritual authority in the church, there's also a sense in which he is just another member of the church when it comes to certain aspects of church life. And so, yes, he has authority, but he needs to be careful that that authority is not abused. And so he uses that kind of a description. Then we come to verse 2, and it says this. He says, feed the flock of God. The primary work of a pastor is to feed the flock of God. And so the Bible describes the church as sheep. That's the illustration that's used. And so that has the idea of a lot of dependence. Now, that doesn't mean that a pastor should be in the place of God in front of those people. That is for Christ. He's not a priest, but he has a lot of important responsibility when it comes to teaching and feeding. And so it's important that I do that. It's important that you come faithfully so that you are being fed. It's important that you pay close attention to what is being stated. It's important that when I preach and when I teach and when others preach and teach, they are being consistent with the scriptures. There are a lot of churches that people go to. They think they're being fed, but the truth is they're not being fed good, wholesome, nutritious, spiritual instruction. They're being fed junk food, okay? And it tastes really nice, but it doesn't make them stronger as Christians. In fact, they're spiritually very deficient. They don't even realize that. And so my primary job as a pastor is that of feeding. I spend more time doing more than anything I do in the week, the most I do is preparing to preach and teach the Word of God. Not that those other things are not important. I mean, part of that, too, is also meeting with people and sometimes dealing with individual specific issues that would fall into that category of feeding. But it's very important. Then he says, taking the oversight thereof. So we see spiritual leadership. If things are not going well in the church, Well, ultimately, it comes to me. That means I'm not leading the way that I should. I once had a person say this to me. Wasn't very flattering, but I think it's probably true. They said, if a fish is starting to rot and stink, where does it start? I don't know. He said, at the head. Okay, thank you for that information. But the point is that if a church isn't healthy, it means there's probably a problem with the leadership. And I'm not saying that a church can't be stubborn and be in a place that it shouldn't be. But the truth is that, generally speaking, we have the statement, everything rises and falls on leadership. There's a lot of truth to that. And when people are being led well, they generally are a lot more healthy than when they're not. And so the responsibility of a pastor is to oversee and to feed. But then he talks about kind of the nature of that. He says, not by constraint, but willingly. In other words, a pastor has to be somebody that has an internal motivation. This is why not everybody can be a pastor. I mean, there are other reasons as well. But you could have a person that's very spiritually mature. They love Christ, but they do not have that internal pressure that is motivating them to take up that oversight and that leadership and that cares for people's hearts. And so a person like that cannot be in pastoral ministry. In other words, we don't put somebody in a position just because we need the position. They have to have that internal desire. Well, a lot of times when we talk about a calling to ministry, I think what that really comes down to is, does this person have that internal passion to lead the people of God? And it's not a selfish, fleshly motivation, but it's a desire to see those people grow and mature in the faith. Then he goes on and says this, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. A pastor can't be greedy. In other words, he doesn't do the work just because he's making money. And in some churches, being greedy wouldn't keep them there very long. But in other churches, it could, because some churches are financially prosperous. Yes?
So sticking out of the pastor's son, back in the day, I think the attitude, even in society, was that pastor or a priest or anyone in our community, that if they have a distraction, like having to get braces for their kids or things like that, be distracted from preparation and trouble, they would be taken care of. They would, like our dentists would give us free dental care, haircuts for that for your.
Yeah.
It wasn't because we were trying to get rich or anything like that, but it was like they wanted to make sure that you were not distracted with having to be focused. Does this make sense? To have to focus on financial things, be more concerned about the job.
Yeah, the reason that a church supports financially their pastor is not because he deserves it. It's because they are freeing him up to be able to focus his attention on the ministry. Now, if he's a very faithful man, then the scripture says he's worthy of double honor, and so the church should take care of him. But the primary reason that a church supports a pastor, it's to free him up so that he can do the work of the ministry. And his work is in caring for people's souls. And so, you know, this issue of not for filthy lucre, with that being said, though, when you get in a position where you can get perks, to put it in that kind of a way, it really has a tremendous temptation connected with it. And, you know, sometimes missionaries connect, you know, they're looking for a meeting, which ultimately means I'm hoping for a free place to stay and a love offering from your church. So I always tell missionaries, if we're not in a position to take you on, we just don't. I mean, you can come and sit in a service, but I don't have you preach, because I'm not trying to feed into that. I mean, having lived in missionary culture, I understand that some missionaries really sacrifice, but others are, well, they're not so much that way. And there's a temptation. I mean, you can get that way after a while. I remember my grandparents used to laugh about their neighbor who was a minister. And they said whenever he wanted something, he'd put on his collar and he'd go to make sure he could get that. And he could. I mean, and so there's a tremendous warning here to those who are in the ministry. And, you know, being in the ministry, you may suffer a lot. But some people taken very good care of, and they actually abuse that as time goes on. So he warns about that. He says, neither as being lords over God's heritage. He said, you're not a master. You are a leader, but you're not a master. You know, my wife and I am the head of our household, but my wife is not my servant. We have a loving relationship. And yes, it's true that when it comes to a decision, I'm the one who's going to bear the responsibility of that. But I don't just say, hey, I don't care what you think. Get in line and just do what I say. I can't do that. I mean, I could, but it wouldn't be a good idea. Well, you know, a lot of times pastors can do that, too. And there's too much laughing over there on the side. A pastor is not a lord. And in fact, Christ, even when he talks about servants and leadership, when he talks to the disciples, he said, you know how the Gentiles exercise their lordship, but it will not be that way among you. You have to be the servant. And so when we talk about oversight, it means that the pastor is the one who's got to take the bullet sometimes. The pastor is the one who's got to have that hard conversation that nobody else wants to have. He's the one who's probably going to be hated after that particular thing falls out. And he has to bear that load. And so it's not the responsibility of everybody in the church. He's got to step up and do that. And then we go on at this. It says this. He says, neither as being lords, but being ensamples, examples to the flock. The strongest way that a pastor can lead is by being an example. You know, when people see this is a very faithful person, when there's a conflict, I see how this person handles that conflict. When there is a need, I see how they respond to that need. Those are the kinds of things that people need to pick up on. And so if a pastor is preaching the word, but his life is not an example, he's really going to make a lot of people angry. Or he's going to make people disillusioned. That hypocrisy is going to be something that kills the work. But if he's an example, it's going to have a very powerful impact. And so all of those things fall under the category of pastoral leadership. Pastors are feeding, they are leading, they're examples. They're the ones that have to take the bullet sometimes. They're the ones that have to really keep in check their love of money, because we don't pay deacons. We don't pay Sunday school teachers. We do pay pastors. And there's a difference. And so there's a different temptation level when you're dealing with those kinds of things. So we're talking about the role of pastors. Any question before we move to the next one? Comments? In Ghana, we'd say contributions, but we have a different mentality when it comes to contribution. Don't mean like I'm going to put my hat out here. Okay, let's move on. Yes?
Well, I was just thinking...
Do you have a contribution?
I might be a deduction.
I will be very quiet unless you ask your question or your comment.
It seems to me, you know, it's not for filthy lucre's sake. It's really just emphasizing that somebody wanting to be a pastor and desiring to have that office is God, yeah. And or should have absolutely nothing to do with being paid or how much they're being paid or
sure.
Whether you're being paid or not. The calling is so much higher mm-hmm. on a spiritual level
yeah.
that the money doesn't even matter. And like even when we were first talking about you over here, I just thought to myself, maybe this is an incorrect presumption upon you, but I would say, I thought to myself, maybe I would say, if Joel feels that this is what God would have him to do, and he was called here, there wouldn't even really be any discussion of the financial compensation. You could make that decision.
And technically, I worked for a month before that discussion was had.
and there you go. And I kind of thought that. It wouldn't have anything to do with it, whether or not you would say, yeah. I mean, if I go to a group for somebody, I want to know how much.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to lose money on it.
A group for somebody is different than being
Yeah, it's true.
Bad in the church. Yeah. It's almost like it's a zero in comparison.
Well, and also, you know, when he says not greedy of filthy lucre, one of the things that is a tremendous temptation for someone who, you know, you can have a person that's not even a believer who goes, that whole ministry thing looks like a nice job. I got to learn what I'm supposed to say and get into that situation. And basically, somebody can begin to taper their message to be very self-serving. I mean, we were in Ghana. We saw this a lot. And I remember we went to this one program, and the program was talking to nonprofits and explained to them how, you know, they were to kind of cooperate with one another in our community and all this kind of stuff. Well, they had a section on fundraising, and guess who they had come in to do the section on fundraising? A local pastor. Yeah, and at the end, guess what they did? They took up an offering, and they put a box in the middle of that room, and they said, okay, we're going to dismiss you one row at a time, and you come up in front of everybody, and you put in your gift. And I said, well, watch everybody in my row go, because I'm not. I'm not doing that. But the truth was that the guy was manipulating all those people. But he does that every Sunday. And lots of people do that in certain parts of the world. And so, yeah, that's a real big issue. It's a real big issue. Yes?
One other thing to point out is that sometimes this passage is used to talk about the plurality of elders, the elders will turn on you. But it's a reminder that this epistle is going to believers throughout the entire region.
Well, the concept of having a team of pastors working together is not a problem. It depends on how they're working together. That's really what it comes down to. There's no question that the majority of the times that he refers to churches, he refers to them as a group of pastors. So there needs to be an understanding of order, but you know, multiple pastors. Most churches that are bigger than 100 have multiple pastors working in them. Okay, but when we talk about plurality of elders, a lot of times what we're thinking about is a little board on the side of people who are not really pastors. They could be called deacons in another kind of church. They could be called a board of trustees in another kind of church, or another they could be called a board of elders, and they are the ruling body of the church. And the pastor pretty much just follows what they want. That's very different than saying we have a team of pastors working together who are working in union. They share the pastoral load, and they understand the order that they're working in. So
this pastor is not referring to that board on the side.
Oh, no, not at all. No, not at all. Absolutely not. It's not. No, that board on the side is something we've created. And probably a lot because of the business model where you have a board of directors and you have CEOs and, you know, you have that kind of a structure. So depending on how that company's set up, where the authority lies could be with the board or something like that. That's obviously not that shouldn't be in the church. I mean, in the church you have spiritual leadership from those who minister in the word, pastor or pastors working together, okay? And they come to make decisions as a church body. There's a vote. It's not a vote from the board over here and here's what we decided to do. And that's what actually ends up happening in those kinds of churches. You know, a Presbyterian type of a polity. And some Bible churches are like that too. But not necessarily all Bible churches would be quite that way. It depends. Some Bible churches are pretty much like a Baptist church, or they could probably be identified as a Baptist church if you looked at them carefully. And others would be pretty much Presbyterian. And there's hybrids, too. So, yes?
When I used to visit my mother-in-law's church, I kind of found it shocking when they would take up the offering and they'd bring it to the pastor and he would look at it and he'd say, no, that wasn't enough. And he would send it right back out. I was like, what? Okay.
Wow. Okay. That's a little bit over the edge.
And it was a Southern Baptist church in California.
Okay. Well, actually, that's a real common practice overseas. Churches in Ghana, I didn't sit in services, but Three or four offerings in a service could happen. It could be an hour of offering time. That definitely happened. It was very shocking to Americans who went and visited some churches like that. I would say there are churches in our here in this city that probably do that too. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's a way to make visitors feel welcome.
But it's a culture. I'm not saying it's right, but it's acceptable. It's become acceptable in certain church cultures. It's unbiblical, but yeah.
A friend that I know, she was telling me that she visited a church in Baltimore City one time, and they send her offering envelopes every year, so she can contribute. And she feels like she's putting in towards that church because she's sending that offering in. It's a whole sense of security for her. And
yeah.
She's giving to a church that she's called her church. She's visited one.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We could really digress into quite a conversation, but no, it's Peter says that we were not redeemed with corruptible things as silver and gold. Some people don't realize that, unfortunately, and that's what they're doing. They're hoping to buy their eternity. Okay, let's transition to the deacon. All right, Acts chapter 6, verses 1-5 is. A real important passage because it talks to us about the first time that they chose deacons. Can anybody tell us what was going on in Acts chapter 6? The Greek widows were being neglected. Yes. And we have a Jew Gentile. We kind of have a mixture of Hellenistic Jews and then non-Hellenistic Jews. And all that actually goes all the way back to when the Jews came back from the captivity. And those who lived in northern Israel had intermarried a lot with the Gentiles. And so they had a kind of different version of Judaism. And so when all those individuals were in the church, the Jews in Jerusalem, who viewed themselves as the true Jews, were very prejudiced towards the Hellenistic Jews. And so in Acts chapter 6, we have this section here. In those days, when the number of the disciples was multiplied, there arose a murmuring among the Grecians against Hebrews because their widows were being neglected in the daily ministration. And the 12 called the multitude of the disciples to them and said, "It's not reason that we should leave the word of God and serve tables." Now, that little statement right there really comes down to what a deacon's role is ultimately going to come down to. Their role is to serve tables. There it is. In fact, the word actually, diakonos, has the idea of a servant serving tables. And basically what it's saying, it's not that a pastor can't clean toilets, a pastor can't cut grass, can't vacuum. Pastors can do those things. Pastors are not above those things. I think a pastor shouldn't get to the place where they feel like, it's beneath me, I don't need to do that. But the truth is, there are endless physical needs connected to church life. And if a pastor is always doing those things, guess what he's not doing? He's not studying his Bible. He's not praying for the congregation. He's not visiting people. He's not involved in the spiritual care of the church. He will be stretched too thin, and he will not be able to do that. So things like patching walls and vacuuming halls and that was nice how they rhyme together. Fixing light bulbs, cutting grass, and all those kinds of things. You know, making meals for shut-ins. And some of those are the kinds of things that really would fall into the category of a deacon's job. So a deacon is not a spiritual authority in the church. Not that a deacon is not a spiritual man. He should be a spiritual man, but he's not a spiritual authority. A deacon's not an overseer. The deacon's a servant. And a pastor can give a deacon an area of place where they will oversee. But that kind of comes under that authority structure of oversight. So we see it says this, "Brethren, look ye out among you at 7 men of honest report, full of the Holy Ghost." Obviously, deacons need to be godly people. You know, part of their job description here. whom we may appoint over the business, and we will give ourselves continually to prayer and the ministry of the word. So to put it in real simple terms, a deacon's job is to free up the pastoral leadership, a pastor or those who are ministering in the word, to free them up to focus on pastoral care so that they're not constantly taking care of the physical needs of the church and neglecting the spiritual care of the church. And that's the key. It's not that they're not able or willing to do the physical things. It's that they need to focus their attention on spiritual care. And so it's very, very important. When we go to 1 Timothy chapters 3 and 4, he talks a lot about some widows in the church. And it says they were widows indeed. These were ladies who actually were completely destitute and they needed to be cared for by the church. And the deacons were the ones who were involved in that care. And so when Timothy is talking to the church, that's who would be taking care of those kinds of issues. So any comments or questions about that? Comments or questions? The primary difference between a deacon and a pastor is that their role in the church is one about physical care versus spiritual oversight. And there's a big difference. Okay, right there first.
My question would be, we know missionaries typically will work for a church taking over, pastoral.
Yes.
But how do you see a pastor that is so efficient, so good at delegating, quite frankly, and seeing gifts in his church that everything is able to be taken care of to the point where they kind of work themselves out of a job? Is it time for them to go start another church, or
like a pastor in the States?
Yeah, I just wondered, is there a path
towards
starting
this? Well, a lot of it kind of comes down to the way that God's gifted an individual. There are some pastors that they're the kind of people that will sit in a place for a long time because that's the way that God's wired them and that's the way he's gifted them and that's where their heart is. And there are others who don't stay very long in many places, and it's not that they don't get along with people, but they are initiators. They are more of a church planting, pioneering kind of a mentality. They're probably more like a missionary than a pastor. And so I think that a pastor's got to kind of understand how God's gifted him and how he fits into that. Now, a church can get to a place where it has a good number of men who can legitimately be pastors. And the question is, does that church need to become a 2,000-member congregation, or does that church really need to plant several churches out of it? And I would say, personally, that I think it's more healthy for it to plant sister churches when it starts getting to that place. And I mean, the church has got to be behind it. The leadership has to be behind it. They have to have people who really can do that. I mean, if a church has one, very faithful family, and they have they take half their families and they send them out and start a church and they end up becoming a depleted congregation because of that. That's not good. Okay, so the church has to get to a place where it understands we are in a position we can do this. And they do it. And God can really bless both congregations in those situations. But you gotta I don't know if there's a concrete It's you look at the church and you start realizing, I really think, maybe we got families coming from a good distance and there's not really a good church in that area. And we start realizing, it would be more healthy for them to have a local church there. And we can, as a church, plant a church in that community. That kind of thing can happen. Did you have a... Okay, go ahead.
I think some churches have to be
connected. Yeah, I know that. Well, basically, there's a discussion about whether or not there's such thing as a female deacon. And the reason for that is that there's a lady named Phoebe who was referred to as a servant in the church. And it's the word diakonos in the feminine. Okay, it doesn't necessarily mean that she was viewed as an officer of the church. It just means that she served. And because it's referring to a woman, then it's in the feminine. The reason that I don't think that we have an office is because we don't have any qualifications mentioned for a deaconess. We definitely do for the pastor. We definitely do for the deacon. And if there was another office, then we would expect there to be qualification for that. Now, there is qualification for a woman who is being cared for entirely by the church. She's not an officer, but she had to meet certain qualifications to be viewed as a widow indeed. And so for that one, we do have some very clear statements, but we don't have anything about a deaconess. Was there, Frank?
Well, I was going to say, the comment on what Scott said, the delegation, if you will, of the spiritual oversight and ministry of the word really mm-hmm. is something that shouldn't happen. That pastor really can't delegate that. That's his office.
Yeah, he's not supposed to delegate spiritual care. Unless there are a group of men working together as pastors, they are all legitimately pastors and they have different roles of responsibility. For instance, you know, here at Anchor, we used to have people that worked with youth, and I guess we'd argue whether or not they were actually viewed as pastors. Maybe when they came, they weren't, but it could be at a point in time that a church has several individuals who are definitely viewed as pastors, but they have different roles in their pastoral care, and they understand that, and they work within that.
But teaching Sunday school. I mean, pastor would still oversee that. You can teach on this. What you do on this, and then even specifically what you might.
Yeah. So people should. You know, people may want to be teachers. Well, ultimately, who's going to make the decision? Who teaches? The pastorship. He should even think about what they need to be teaching on. I mean, not that he has to plan every lesson with them or something like that, but, you know, there needs to be some continuity to the instruction that's going on in the church.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, as a church member, it's like, okay, a pastor, okay, he has, you know, like a person teaching a class, a Sunday school class, whatever it is the most, you know, example in my mind that I can see where it's like everything they say or do or teach he can't really be in a practical sense, but it's like as a church member, I don't think a person is really accountable to necessarily submit to something that anybody would say or teach, like in that kind of situation, other than their pastor really. And
I could say that anything that comes from a lectern that's not biblical shouldn't be submitted to. So whether it came from the pastor or whether it came from a church member. But I think what you're communicating is that you put a lot more weight on something coming from a pastor's instruction than an average church member teaching.
Well, that's the spiritual authority that you've submitted yourself to when you join that church. And so while the pastor could have somebody else do this or teach that, it's always kind of sort of, there's a caveat there that this is, you know.
A pastor's job is to make sure that what's going on in the church, what's being taught, is biblical. And so, okay, let's say that I delegate to someone to teach Sunday school class, and they start getting into something that's clearly not biblical. I have to pull them aside. We need to have a conversation or a series of conversations that may very well end up with them not teaching anymore, then or ever. Or it can get difficult, actually. But the truth is that as a pastor, you want to put people where you feel like they have the giftedness. You feel like you have confidence in where they are doctrinally. They're not over their head, that kind of a thing. So, you know, pastors shouldn't get in this situation, but theoretically they could, you know. Yeah, they definitely can. So, where they put someone in a teaching position, they're not really sure where that person is and they end up realizing that that person is over their head and what they're addressing, or maybe doctrinally they're not in the place where the pastor would be comfortable. Those things can happen, and then they have to deal with it. So, all right. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Let's move on to another topic, and I want to talk for a minute about ordination. Okay. And I was ordained at Anchor 10 years ago, I guess, almost. There was a certain process, and there are some very prominent pastors in church history that were not ordained. Does anyone know any of those people's names? Anybody know? Huh? Prominent pastors in church history. Okay, prominent false teachers in church history. I have no idea if he was ordained. He could very well have been ordained. Charles Spurgeon was not ordained, believe it or not. He did not have a formal seminary theological training. Another very well-known pastor would be Martin Lloyd-Jones, two individuals who were not technically ordained. But I would have to say that if we look at what the word ordained means, they actually were ordained, because ordination simply means a formal appointment to an office. And Charles Spurgeon was most definitely formally appointed to an office at the Metropolitan Tabernacle, and Martin Lloyd-Jones was most definitely formally appointed to an office at Westminster Chapel in London. But I want to talk a little bit about how we should look at that. And whether you realize it or not, every year when we come to that time to have a transition with deacons, let's say we vote on some new deacons, or some deacons step down because they've finished their term, or whatever goes on there, when we appoint a deacon, we could use the term ordained to an office. I don't think that's very typical for us to use that, but what we're basically saying is there's a formal process by which we take an individual and we put them in an office, and we do it as a church. And we put our hands on them and say, God has called us to place you in this office for, and, you know, constitutionally for a deacon for a period of time that's determined. For a pastor, it's an indefinite thing. Apart from them stepping down or the church having to remove them, it's an indefinite thing. And so how exactly do we talk about this issue of ordination? Well, let me kind of talk about how it happens during apostolic time and how it would work today. First of all, who is it that ordains a pastor or appoints a pastor? Anybody know? The apostles. So they're dead. How are they going to do it? The church. Very good. The church. It started with the apostles. But what we have to realize is that the apostles' role was to lay the foundation, say, here is the pattern that you're supposed to follow. So when Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 3, and when Paul writes to Titus in Titus chapter 1, and he says, I want you to appoint elders in every city, Titus. I want you to make sure that if a man desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. But he must be, and he lists those things. What we need to realize is that when Paul is writing that, he's essentially giving them the book of 1 Timothy that is going to be their instruction. This is how we do it. And so that's where it starts. We go back to Paul's instruction as well. At least we're supposed to. Hopefully if we do as a church. Every time we look at bringing a deacon on, or whether we look at appointing a pastor, we are supposed to go back to what Paul told those men, because that is the pattern. So it's the church who appoints the leadership. Very important. They're the ones that make that judgment. It is possible for someone to be a pastor in one church, but not in another, because those congregations, one can follow one man's leadership, and another church can't follow that same man's leadership. That is possible. A lot of it has to do with the personality of the church, how they view certain areas that are a little bit on the subjective side as opposed to the objective side. And so when we talk about ordaining a pastor or ordaining a deacon, in the apostolic time, Paul receives specific instruction from God, and he writes it down and sends it to these churches. And they are responsible to make the judgment about who is qualified to do that. In our current situation, we go back to what Paul wrote and what has been preserved. 1 Timothy, Titus, 1 Peter. And we take that instruction and then we apply that instruction. Pastors don't ordain pastors. Missionaries don't ordain pastors. Bible institutes and Christian colleges don't ordain pastors. Churches under the authority of Scripture make that decision. And so even if we call an ordination council, the purpose of that council is so that there is a theological questioning in front of the congregation, because within the congregation we may not have that same level of theological training, I guess you could say. And so your average church member may not know what kinds of questions to ask that particular candidate. But it should be done in front of the congregation, because they're going to make a judgment about whether or not this person is spiritually qualified, has the gifts, and has the grounding to be able to be in that office. And when a group of pastors do the ordination council, they discuss and they make recommendations to the congregation, but ultimately the congregation votes on that candidate. So that's what's going on. It's not that we call in a group of pastors and say, okay, you're going to appoint them or not. Those individuals simply question in front of the congregation so that the congregation makes the decision about the candidate. That is how it should happen. Yes?
Historically, has an ordination been local? So when someone is ordained, are they being ordained to that specific ministry, as contrasted with today, where someone is ordained and then they can go wherever they want and say, I've been ordained?
Well, the purpose, if the word ordained means to appoint to an office, you're appointed to the office in the church that recognizes your qualification. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, if you are ordained, you should be ordained into the work of pastoral ministry in the church in which you are ordained. And if you're going out of that church, you should be going with the recommendation of that congregation. And another church is going to make a decision based on your recommendation and their own judgment as well. Do you follow what I'm saying there?
Yeah,
go ahead. Frank, go ahead.
So, well, I was thinking the same thing like Tori was saying. So, you were ordained here, but you weren't ordained as a pastor of the church.
No, not technically.
So, then, suppose that we voted and...
To be honest with you, my ordination I think if we wanted to be very particular about it, using it in the biblical sense, I would say my ordination was what happened recently, not actually what happened 10 years ago.
Well, you were.
Yeah.
Right. So somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, not that I had I have heartburn about what happened at all. Okay, and that's how we kind of do it in our independent Baptist culture. But really, ordination is talking about appointment to an office.
So really, the only real ordination that would be a particular church
appointing a pastor.
Appointing that some person as a pastor.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? You're ordained now, but you're not a pastor. So
yeah, that would not really make sense. Now, what?
Is that kind of what we do, though, isn't it?
We can sit down and talk about it. But let me kind of explain the purpose. For instance, what Anchor did with me when I was getting ready to go to the mission field. Basically, what Pastor Kahneman was doing, and it was good, is he's saying, we recognize that Joel is qualified and gifted to do pastoral ministry work. And so we are going to send him out as a missionary. And we are sending him out with our blessing as one from our congregation. And so the ordination was sort of to give some weight in the eyes of other pastors and say, we can get behind this man's ministry and we can support him. We can partner with him. That's really essentially what the purpose of that really ultimately was. And for instance, let's say that we were down the road going to start another church. Okay? We have a young man, maybe he's 25 or 30 or whatever. Married, he's got one kid, he's been serving like an assistant. We haven't viewed him as a pastor necessarily, but he's been like a preacher boy. Okay, he's been working in the church. And we really believe that this is a young man who God's hand is on him, he's gifted for the ministry. And as a church, we're sending him out to plant another church. That church plant is not technically a church until it properly organizes. And we're going to help it organize. And so when we send him out, he's kind of being sent out under the authority of our church. So this is a very interesting discussion.
Okay.
Let's go right here. Yeah.
Technically, it's still appointed to a position, even if the position is missionary.
appointed as a missionary. Sure. Yeah, you have a great point.
As opposed to ordaining somebody that wants to go out and become a lead pastor somewhere else, that's not really something being ordained to a position in the church. This is one being ordained as a pastor.
Well, if somebody wants to be ordained and then they go out looking for a church.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we do it, but I'm not saying it's necessarily ordered the way it would have been biblically. Huh? We probably all have. Well, there might have been other reasons that led to that other than that. But, yeah, good.
A lot of other cultures and religious groups, I guess you would say, look at that as basically your letter of recommendation.
Yeah.
If you've been ordained, then that says that someone, basically, they look at it as almost a vetting process. Okay?
Yeah.
We've seen how you work, you're in the work. This is basically us putting our recommendation.
Our stamp of recommendation.
Where in Bible times they would be sent with a letter from a ruler or a king or something. This is basically them saying, hey, we've seen this guy, he's in the word, we approve of what he's doing, we've ordained him.
Well, even technically, as funny as this might sound, when somebody leaves our church to go to another one, really, that pastor should ask for a letter of recommendation from us to accept that individual on the basis of that recommendation. That's and that does happen in some churches.
Yeah,
it should happen, really.
They used to actually send letters to a letter.
And it would, frankly speaking, read out a lot of the weird things that happen in churches. Just leave it at that, you know. Okay, our time is already gone. Unbelievable. Okay, we will stop there. This actually could be a really good discussion. A lot of practical things. And I think it's good for us as a church to have these kinds of discussions. So we think about, you know, before you come to an ordination council, you're like, what are we doing here? What is this even something we should be doing? What is the purpose of that? I think that those are questions that we should kind of answer beforehand, so that when those things happen, we have a very good, solid understanding. When we vote, we understand this is what we're voting on, and all those kinds of things. So, very, very good. All right, let's pray, and we will close here.